The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to a very special edition of the Space Show for Monday evening. I'm your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in. Our guest tonight is Dr. Greg Autry. More about that in just a minute. One quick announcement. We're on a 60-minute format tonight. So if you do have a comment or a question for our guest, make sure you pay attention to the clock and get it to us before we end the program. And we would like to hear from you. So for sure, calling us at 1-866-687-7223 is our preferred way of reaching us. And then, of course, you can use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment on our blog. And as soon as you hit the send button, I will get it and can bring it up on air. Our blog is on the website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right, the upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed. You open that page just as you would any blog page, and comments and questions are down at the bottom. Please remember you can log in and do this all as a guest. You do not have to be a participant or a member or log in to the Discuss program, which handles our blog commentary. And again, our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. One more quick question. Remember that Sunday is Mother's Day, and we do not do Space Show programs on Mother's Day or Father's Day. So everybody gets a day off and spend it with your family and have a good time. And now back to our program tonight. As I said, our guest is Dr. Greg Autry, and his full bio is up on the website right now, but he is an educator, writer, and a technology entrepreneur. He researches and publishes on space commerce, entrepreneurship, technology innovation, and trade policy. He's an assistant professor of clinical entrepreneurship at the Marshall School of Business at USC, that's in Los Angeles, where he teaches entrepreneurship and technology commercialization courses. He's also a firm believer in humankind's future in the solar system. He's been conducting research into new space, commercial space industry since 2003, and he writes and comments regularly on space topics and serves on the editorial board of the New Space Journal. He has served on the NASA agency review team and as White House liaison to NASA. He advocates increasing funding for exploration and development, engaging both entrepreneurial and traditional firms. Again, I urge you to read his full bio. It's most impressive. We're very, very fortunate to have Greg back with us tonight. And one other thing, he is the chairman of the National Space Society's premier ISDC conference this year, which is in early June in Alexandria, Virginia. Greg, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you for having me. I always love to be here.
Let's start out, and ISDC, right in the home of all the policy wonks and the people that make things happen or don't make things happen, depending on your point of view. tell us a bit about what you have in store for us this year.
Yeah, well, I'd encourage everybody, first of all, to go to ISDC2019.nss.org and check it out. For those that aren't familiar, ISDC is a conference that's been hosted for many, many years by the National Space Society. And we move it around from city to city. Traditionally, the D.C. show has never been a really highly attended show, but I'm happy to say that this year our attendance is registrations are already breaking all records, as are our sponsorships. So we're really pleased with that. And the lineup of speakers, like, wow, you know, go check out Under Schedule, the speaker lineup. We'll be opening with NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. We've got former astronaut Eileen Collins. We've got Al Warden. We're going to have Miles O'Brien, who I really love to hear from. Dr. Scott Pace, who's the head of the National Space Council. It's just one heck of a lineup. We'll be giving a special award to Tori Bruno from United Launch Alliance. We've got Kevin O'Connell at the Office of Space Commerce. If you've never heard him speak, he's really interesting. I love the things he's doing over at Commerce, and he's got some very innovative views of it. We've got Lori Garber, who is, of course, long associated with NSS and was former NASA deputy administrator and known as a really interesting commercial advocate. I could go on, but you should check it out.
And then you have multiple tracks with lots of very interesting papers. You have, I noticed, really interesting luncheon and two dinner programs as well, correct?
Exactly. Actually, I think we've got three dinner programs now. We just added, it's not officially announced, I'll announce it here, Mark Sarangelo, formerly of Sierra Nevada Corporation, who I actually worked for a little bit with on the Dream Chaser project many years ago, and who is now the special advisor to the NASA Administrator on Commercial Space, will be our Wednesday night dinner guest, and that is a deal we just made with him.
Ah, terrific. Yeah, because I just checked it yesterday, and he was not on the list. So
yeah, it's not up there. I'm waiting for him to send me his picture and bio, but I've said it on the space show, so he's committed now.
Excellent. So it's a great lineup. Are you a speaker, or are you just going to be busy running around?
Yeah, I'll be speaking at several points during introduction, and then I'm on a Space 2.0 panel with Rod Pyle, the author of many great books, who I'm sure you know well.
Yeah, he's on the show frequently. Yeah, Lori hasn't been on the show in a while, but Rod is a good friend, and he's frequent. He's the most prolific author I have this year. So
yeah, since Isaac Asimov died, it's pretty much Rod as far as prolific author.
Oh, on Apollo and Space 2.0 and you name it. So it's a pretty full week. So can people still, you know, make plans, get reservations? Is the hotel sold
Absolutely.
Out? What about logistics?
I think the hotel may actually be sold out, but there's plenty of hotels in that Pentagon City area. This is at the Pentagon City Sheraton, so you shouldn't have any problem finding a place to stay. It's worth checking to see if there's still rooms. We can still you can still get in the conference, but the trend is looking really good. So get your registration in now.
And can you get luncheon and dinner tickets on the scene, or do you have to do them in advance?
I recommend doing them in advance. It may be possible to do them a day in advance at the site, but I strongly recommend if you want to get into these dinners to do that in advance. They're going to be pretty well attended when you look at the quality of folks we have.
Do you expect any great new policy news to come out of any of these people? Can we expect something really firm, like taking us back to the moon, or more of the same?
The theme of our conference is Back to the Moon to Stay, and I, of course, am not speaking on behalf of these individuals, but you've got the right individuals all together in D.C., and it would be a good place for them to maybe share something with us. We'll see, and there's just, wow, so much happening in space from a policy perspective. It's more active than it's been since probably the Apollo days.
You have an email from Joy in Dallas, Texas, and she says, do you have any members of any of the House or Senate committees that deal with space attending, especially those from the Oversight Committee that have had interesting comments expressed by their new chairwoman?
So we have a full policy day on Wednesday, and I will tell you that I have invited Representative Kendra Harn from Oklahoma, and so far, her schedulers haven't fitted in, but I am hopeful that that could happen. But officially, now she's not on the agenda. We were trying to make that happen. But if you look at the Space Policy Day on Wednesday, Steve Wolf of Spacecom is running that day, and he has lined up a pretty interesting group of folks.
Unfortunately, that's my fly-in day, so I'll probably miss most of that. So. Are you streaming any of it? Will any of the conference be streamed this year live? Will we be able to see things we've missed or for people who can't attend?
Yeah, one of my goals is to get everything recorded. The logistics of streaming live are unlikely, but we do hope to make the majority of it available afterwards and some of the most important stuff available very quickly.
What about networking for people like Scott Pace, Bridenstine? Mm-hmm. Do they typically stick around? Do they meet with people that are there and talk with the normal folk?
Yeah, you know, again, I can't speak for them, but this is a conference that's grassroots, and it's our objective, and I think they understand that this is the people's conference. This isn't one of these typical military-industrial complex conferences where, you know, people that don't have uniforms and suits never get any attention. This is the grassroots conference. So I think you'll see Jim and Scott shaking the hands and talking to folks. But again, I can't account for their schedule or their personal inclinations, but they're pretty straightforward guys. I think that that you'll have good interaction.
I hear from people all the time that are sort of neophytes in space but really like it, and they are intimidated to go to these events because they think they're not adequately prepared or knowledgeable enough or in the industry. How does that profile fit with what we both know exists at ISDC, but I'd like it to come from you rather than me?
Yeah, again, this is the People's Conference, and it is, I think, a joyous event. It's a family gathering. Now, truly, almost everybody knows everybody in the space industry, so, you know, you and I know Rod, and Rod knows Laurie, and, you know, I consider myself to be good friends with Charlie Bolden, who was Obama's NASA administrator, even though I worked in the, you know, Trump administration. It's a community where we share this this better vision for humanity, and, you know, we're all kind of Star Trek geeks, and it's a very approachable group of people. And I have to say, when I joined the community in a serious way, I was always a space fan, but back in 2002, 2003, I decided I was going to study the commercial space industry as my research topic in management scholarship. And I started going out to the events, and I was amazed how easy it was to, you know, at that time, go talk to folks like Paul Allen or Richard Branson. And, you know, I've had that opportunity since then simply because I stood up and did it. And it's an approachable group of people, David, and you know that.
Well, I know, and of the people you mentioned up front, I think maybe 70% of the people you mentioned have all been space show guests at least once. Many of them, even Tory Bruno, has been on multiple times. So,
Tory's amazing. I mean, if you tweet Tory, there's a good chance he's going to tweet right back at you. And
that's how I got him on the show. I sent him a tweet and said, would you like to come on the space show? And he said, sure, tell me about it. So I got in touch with his secretary, and the rest was history. But very personable guy, and people meet and talk with him. And Scott Pace is the same way. And so, you know, for people sitting on the sidelines and being intimidated, there's no need for it, to say the least.
And NASA Administrator Bridenstine is one of the nicest human beings I know. I had the opportunity to kind of get to know him a little bit before he was nominated for the position, and I supported him all along just because, again, he was an approachable guy. He was in Congress, and I asked to talk to him about issues I cared about, space and China, and he made time. I wasn't from his state, and again, a very approachable person.
So I know you have tours and side activities, so if people come there with their families or spouses, There's activities for them to do that are somewhat related. You want to speak to some of those activities or tours?
Sure. I mean, first of all, you're in Washington, D.C., and, you know, there's just a lot of great stuff to do. So if you're considering traveling to ISDC, obviously it's a location where there's so much to do, not to mention, you know, of course, the National Mall and the main Smithsonian Museum. But we're going to have a tour out to the, and I always worry about the pronunciation here, the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is, you know, out by the airport in Dulles that people don't get too much. And that is just one big, amazing room of astounding space hardware. We're going to have a tour out to Goddard, where you can learn about the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and what's happening with James Webb, two really exciting projects. There's going to be an iFly tour if you want to go play parachutist in the wind tunnel. That'll be fun. Yeah, please come out. But it's not a place where your family feel like they're stuck. You know, sometimes you get in a town when there's not much to do, but there's plenty to do in D.C.
What else should we mention before we move to another topic? Anything we've missed in terms of highlighting ISDC or something?
If you go to the website, you'll see there's a special student track with a special discounted student registration. There's a student debate going to go on space policy topics surrounding issues of international concern and globalism that's kind of interesting. There's, I think, something for anybody who's interested in space. We're even looking for student volunteers. If you want, you can go to About tab and click on volunteers, and we'd love to find something for you to do. Who knows, you might end up escorting Buzz Aldrin around the conference. That's happened before.
What about an exhibit hall and industry exhibits and shows and meeting industry people? Is that present this year?
Yeah, this particular venue is a tight space area. The space community will be literally in a tight space, and there isn't a lot of room for a big exhibit hall. So we won't have a traditional fill your bag with Chatsky's sort of exhibit. We will have an art exhibit and some student work, and a couple of sponsors are going to set up tables, but there won't be a big exhibit hall. It's mostly about talking and meeting with people.
Okay. Let me move you on a little bit to some other topics that I talk about on the space show. I get dismissed all the time for this topic, but I'd love to pick your brain about it. And that is, because of my economic background in graduate school, I see our national debt, which I looked it up just before the show tonight, and the clock goes faster than I can talk, but roughly $22.3 trillion. And it appears that Trump and the Democrats just agreed on another $2 trillion for an infrastructure, which puts us up getting close to $25 trillion. NASA is a discretionary item on the budget. So how are we even rationally talking about being able to go to the moon, afford this, do that? Does the national debt mean anything? As I told you before the show, when I was in graduate school, they said, hey, we owe it to ourselves. Don't worry about it. It doesn't mean anything. That's not really factual anymore. What is your take on it? I mean, I don't see how we can do very much when we owe so very much.
Yeah, well, I am an economist by training. My PhD is in the area of public policy and economics. I am quite concerned about this issue, so thank you for bringing it up, David. First of all, you know, you mentioned the debt at $23 trillion, and that is a number that doesn't reflect the unfunded mandates, particularly the liabilities associated with Social Security and Medicare, which together add more than $50 trillion more. So the scary thing, if you go to usdebtclock.org, as you mentioned, and you go down to the bottom, they've got a ticker that shows U.S. unfunded liability gap. And that number is $124 trillion. It's $100 trillion more than the debt. And this is money we've committed to pay for people's care that we don't have. And just to be clear, I know a lot of people have this vision from FDR that the Social Security money was put in this trust fund and it's sitting there in a bank vault somewhere, you know, waiting for them to retire. And that ain't so, Bucky. There's no money. Congress spent it all. They've taken that money out of the nominal trust fund. And the other problem was, when Social Security was passed in the mid-1930s, the average life expectancy in this country was 55 years old. Almost nobody lived to 65 to collect Social Security. It was made to take care of a small group of people who ended up in a highly vulnerable situation when they were that old and didn't have any income. People did not retire. They generally died while they were still working, and that was the way the world was. In 1967, when President Johnson put in Medicare, the average life expectancy in the United States was 67. So people were only expected to receive Medicare for 2 years. And we didn't have half of the expensive treatment. Now we've got a situation where The average life expectancy in the U.S. is about 83. So people are retiring and living for another 20 years and consuming medications and treatments and tests that were inconceivable when these programs were developed. And the assumption is, if science can invent it medically, you're entitled to it. And that is non-sustainable, and it threatens our space program and every other discretionary program, including the entire Defense Department. If you look at the growth of the mandatory budget versus the budget that the administration and Congress have some control over, the discretionary, it's getting to be completely out of whack. And we're going to be to the point in the next 20 years where there's no NASA, there's very little DOD, there's certainly no Department of Energy, National Science Foundation, or art projects, or anything else except for Medicare and Social Security. And that's the third rail that no politician wants to touch, because, you know, AARP will ruin your life if you say that, but it's the truth, that we've got to think about it if we care about these other programs. Now, that said, if you don't mind me putting some happy news on it, I think things like infrastructure, which you mentioned the President and Congress are actually agreeing on, and NASA, which the President and Congress have agreed on, are areas where you get a return on your investment. When you put money into those things, you get more money back. The one thing I like to say to folks about the space program, if you look at the NASA budget, right now it's about $20 billion after a little bit of an uptick. Again, thank Congress and the President. And the military defense budget's about $25 billion. So we've got a total of about $45 billion being spent on space in this country. Motorola did a study a few years ago on long-haul trucking fleets that were equipped with global positioning systems that they sold. And they were trying to see what the value of adding GPS to a truck fleet was. And they came up with a number of $52,000 per truck. This is from fuel, of course, less wear and tear on the vehicle, reduced tire usage, reduced driver time, reduced accidents, better logistics, knowing when the truck would arrive at the loading bay, less insurance, and a whole number of factors. So $52,000 a year per truck, and there's a million of these trucks in the country, David. That's $52 billion per year returned to the U.S. economy only from trucks. That's more than the entire NASA and DOD space budgets combined, and we get that back just in trucks, not to mention what it does for our environment by reducing fuel usage and CO2 emissions in vehicles all around the world. It's by far the greatest system for reducing carbon emissions that's ever been invented. Every ship at sea and all aircraft making transoceanic flights are at least 15% more efficient than they would be otherwise. So anyway, I advocate still for spending that money, even though it's hard to justify to somebody who is concerned about the budget and views, again, the social programs as being more important. We get our money back, though, when we invest in science and engineering.
And so going to the moon, does that improve what you're talking about or just sustain what you're talking about?
Well, it does not directly, I think, pay for itself, but neither did Apollo. But there's a great quote from the head of China's Chang'e lunar program, and I don't have it in front of me, but he said something to the effect of that the American lunar program invigorated the American economy and created the technology boom that fueled the economic growth of the U.S. in the second half of the 20th century, and he's dead on. It's why he wants his country to do this. So we didn't know, you know, that we were going to get GPS, that we were going to get memory foam mattresses, that we were going to get remote medical telemetry, that we were going to, in a lot of ways, get the PC and the Internet businesses. You know, the Internet was put in place by ARPA, a project launched in response to Sputnik, along with the Apollo missions. And one of the top developers for the ARPANET, which became the Internet, was a NASA engineer who initiated that program and got $1 million grant for it. And then he went on to work at Xerox PARC, which is essentially the company that developed the modern personal computer. And we didn't know any of these things were going to happen when we decided to get serious about solving a giant engineering problem. But when you solve giant engineering problems, you get these really positive externalities. And World War II, you know, is not something I would justify as a goal, but it gave us jet aircraft, it gave us radar and the microwave oven and antibiotics and just a countless number of things that returned huge value to our economy because we had to solve engineering problems to meet our war goals. And I think that's better when you're solving your tough engineering problems going to the moon. So I don't know what we're going to get out of it, David, but I can tell you from many, many years of history, it will have massive returns to our economy.
It's interesting you mention all of these great spinoffs, and yet when you try to, not you specifically, but you in general, try to sell space based on spinoffs, it's a big flop. I don't understand that because try to live without the spinoffs.
I said, I think the GPS thing is just so darn obvious. And, you know, I'm only talking trucks. When you think of all the smartphone apps from Google Maps to Pokemon Go, that are enabled by having GPS and knowing where we are we're all the time. And I hate to say it, but I think you and I are both old enough to remember what it was like trying to go meet somebody somewhere when you didn't have a map in your pocket all the time and you didn't have a way to communicate with them. You had barely agreed to meet at a street address at a particular time. And you wandered up and down and parked and tried to talk to somebody or go into a gas station and borrow a map.
Well,
it was a very inefficient world, and I can't even calculate how much you saved by simply having a map and a communications device in your pocket.
I remember all the jokes about guys refusing to ask for directions when they're floating around getting lost to go someplace. So
exactly. So the Y chromosome needed a smartphone. Anybody should be able to see the value of the spinoffs. And there are direct payoffs, too, that we're going to see with lunar resources and, you know, the abilities to manufacture products in space. Space solar energy has a lot of promises. Some of it is direct, and a lot of it will be what we call economic externalities.
Why do you think trying to sell space based on spinoffs doesn't work very well?
You know, I think, honestly, often the spin-offs have been the wrong thing. I don't hear people talking about GPS as much as I do the memory foam mattresses, you know?
Uh-huh.
I love my memory foam mattress. I think that the tracking number I just gave you is
much more compelling.
It's pretty hard to deny that. And that's, like I said, the entire DOD and NASA budget every single year. If people can't see that, I don't get it. I'm writing an article for Foreign Policy right now on, in fact, the environmental benefits of space, and I'm going to hit several of those topics.
You have an email from Barbara in Phoenix. And listeners, let me remind you, you can give us a call, 866-687-7223. Barbara says, Greg, all of this doesn't happen in a vacuum. So while we may be borrowing the money and spending the money on space and the military budget and the things that you're talking about, it appears that the direction the United States may be heading is that we're going to be spending money on even more and bigger entitlements like Medicare for all, absorbing everybody's college loans, all sorts of different things. So while the space may be returning something, you've got all these other expenditures going on, and we're borrowing for that as well. So, again, space doesn't happen in a vacuum. So I'm curious how the benefits rate when you're spending on all sorts of other things that don't have this kind of return to the economy.
Yeah, well, I want to be careful not to to open a Pandora's box of all those other topics. As an educator, though, I will touch briefly on the issue of student loans. I think we've done an incredible disservice to the millennial generation by telling them all that they had to go to college. And I am a college professor, and I'm saying that wasn't right. We devalued the trades. We devalued manufacturing in this country. There were so many people who made well, particularly in the aerospace industry, as machinists and production engineers, who many of them did not get traditional college educations. They went to trade schools or they learned on the job, and they were some of the smartest people I've ever worked with. We somehow convinced a whole generation they had to go to college, borrow money. Many of them end up with $100,000 or more in student debt, and they find themselves applying at Starbucks, which is curious, you know, as to whether their college degree came from the prestigious of that university to be a barista. And so that's a mess. How to handle it, I'm not sure, but I think the main thing is to stop lying to our students. And, you know, I actually tell my business students that if you're worried about money and you want a six-figure job, walk out of my classroom and apprentice yourself to an electrician. I guarantee you that you'll make six figures and you'll be happy. You know, if you want to run up $250,000 in debt, get a finance job on Wall Street, I bless you. But there's a good chance that you'll make less than an electrician to begin with anyway.
Or a welder. So, welders make a lot of money, too.
Exactly. Or a plumber. Let's not do that. That said, people are making commitments for us that are going to detract from investments in infrastructure, which we need, and investments in space, what we need. But we have to be smart as a nation and realize if you borrow money, and I don't necessarily advocate it for it, but if you borrow money, it should be spent only on things that have a return on investment. So from a personal finance standpoint, I'm going to tell people, if you borrow money, borrow it because you're putting it into an asset like a house that appreciates, and that maybe you're getting a tax write-off that helps pay for that as well. Don't borrow money to buy a car, which is an asset that devalues. And as a nation, we shouldn't be doing the equivalent of borrowing money to buy cars. We should only be borrowing money if we're investing it in something that's going to let us pay that money back. Another important point that's scary is the amount of money that we owe in interest is rapidly rising and on its way to 10% of our annual spending. And if interest rates go up, which the Fed chair keeps kind of poking at, many of the bonds that we owe are interest-adjustable bonds that were introduced about a decade ago, and we're going to have to start paying more on those. And, of course, the cost of new borrowing will go up with that as well. So the cost of that debt could get much, much worse than it is now in an environment that isn't so conducive to cheap borrowing.
So do they reduce what they might spend on infrastructure or NASA, for example, as interest costs go up, or do they just leave everything the same and they just end up borrowing more money overall?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you, I'm not a fan of borrowing money, but if the only choice was to borrow more money or keep putting money into NASA and infrastructure, I would borrow more money and put it into NASA and infrastructure, because as long as we're paying the very low rates the Treasury bonds are paying out, in the couple of percent range, we get a better return on the money we put into NASA and infrastructure. What we can't do is, again, pay for things that don't have a return on investment if we're not making money as a country, and we need to get back to making money as a country. And we need to, all of us, be telling the story about why space pays. It's not just pretty pictures. It's not just glorious astronauts. It's something that makes our country wealthy, successful, and a geopolitical power in the world.
You have another question, and this is Lonnie in Denver, Colorado. And Lonnie says, I wonder if you have ever thought, and I'm sure you'll think I'm joking, but actually I'm not joking, of creating a basic online economic course that Congress critters have to take to help them understand what you're talking about, because it doesn't seem like Congress pays any attention to any economic rules or fundamentals or anything. Have you ever thought of designing a congressional, simple online economic course to help them understand what you're talking about?
Wow. So a couple of things there. I have had the opportunity, having worked for many years on advocacy for space, long before I had a position in the administration, talking to members of Congress, and I've also advocated on the trade reform topic quite a bit. So I spent a lot of time with members of Congress on both sides and their staffers. And the first thing I want to tell your listeners is, believe it or not, they're a lot smarter than you think they are. It is hard in our highly competitive environment to get into the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate, obviously. without being a pretty clever person. And most of them, and this is definitely not all, but most of them are much more approachable and open-minded than you would think. And if you can have a private conversation with them, you can actually talk about these things. And I could probably put the average Democrat from the House, the average Republican in the House, and me and sit in a room and reach a deal on the debt or immigration or any number of policies. But the minute the TV cameras come out, they run to their corners in order to energize their base and get reelected for 2 years so they can do the thing they think it is that they really are there to do. And it's a real shame because all the other issues become proxies for reelection. And again, they have to energize that base. So they take these topics like Social Security and Medicare and you know, wrap themselves in them and become inflexible. It's not that they don't understand the economics as much as that our system does not allow them to honestly discuss the economics. That said, as far as an easy to understand macroeconomic lessons, my PhD advisor, Peter Navarro, who is now the president's advisor on trade and manufacturing, a rather controversial position, taught macroeconomics at UC Irvine for many years, and he has a great online narrated set of lessons on micro and macroeconomics, and I strongly suggest you you look those up. They're non-controversial, and they're easy to understand and address many of these topics in a fair and balanced way.
And they're at UC Irvine?
I'll have to find you the URL. Perhaps I can look it up while we continue talking, but I know that they were online.
And you don't have to be enrolled as a student in the university. You can just...
No, Peter put them online available to anybody. So.
Okay. I would love it if you could find the URL eventually and let me know, and I'd share it with the listeners. Another area, and listeners, I'm going to switch topics because, again, we're doing a 60-minute format. But if you have a question about economics and what we've been talking about, or you want to give us a call at 866-687-7223, go ahead and do so. But you wrote a foreign policy article in early April, I guess it was, Beijing's fight for the final frontier. U.S. commercial space efforts are being undercut by aggressive Chinese plans. And China is in the news all the time. It's certainly been in the news last couple of days on trade issues with the president and the administration, and certainly on technology and China. And I follow a lot of different space blogs. One of them is Howard Bloom's blog. And, you know, a lot of people post and dismiss the fears and the concerns and the warnings about China, and others, including some that have Chinese origins and roots, are trying to raise a red flag. And you're hard-hitting and factual, and you're not cutting any corners about what's going on with China and technology and space and why we need to be concerned. Talk to us about how you see things with China and space and technology.
Yeah, so that's a topic that the other one I spent a lot of time on. And I want to be clear, I have immense respect for the people of China and traditional Chinese culture. And I used to be able to spend a lot of time in China until I began criticizing the Communist Party. And like many people who criticize the Communist Party, you get censored. So I am persona non grata there now. That said, my concern about... space is that they have defined it as a strategic industry that they believe their country needs to have a globally competitive position in, and they're right about that. Like I mentioned, I admired the head of their lunar program for noting the economic benefit it had in the U.S., but they're also very aware that space is a geopolitical and military tool that has made the United States undefeatable on the battlefield and rendered our Air Force and Navy superior to any on Earth, and they want to own that. When they identify an industry as strategic, they tend to take the whole thing over. Some previous examples are solar power. Solar power was developed in the United States as a spinoff out of Bell Labs in the 1950s. The folks working on the transistor also worked on semiconductor photovoltaic generation, and a company spun out of that, and it couldn't really find a customer. And the first customer it found actually was the United States satellite program, and the second U.S. satellite, Vanguard, had a set of solar panels on it. And since then, you know, practically every orbital device up there has solar panels on it. And the U.S. government, through funding at NASA and other agencies, has driven the development of solar panels from, you know, a 5% efficiency to the 20-something percent efficiencies, because the most demanding regime in the world is to put them on spacecraft, where you have to have the highest performance per weight that you can possibly get. And so a lot of grant money from the U.S. went into that, and a lot of private money went into that. And then NASA was even the first organization to put solar panels on the ground. And they did this in Indian reservations and remote villages across the world to demonstrate you could use solar PV on a building on the ground. And I wouldn't have it on my house today, where I've got 40 panels running my electric cars, if it wasn't for NASA doing that. The point is, the Chinese decided they wanted that industry. They went and got it. And they essentially put every American solar module and cell company out of business by dumping the products at incredibly low prices. And they did this because most of the Chinese producers are state-owned companies. Even though they have names that sound like they're a private company, they're actually owned by the government or some division of the government. And all of the major banks in China are state-owned, and the funding for these industries comes from these state-owned banks. And when the government and the Communist Party decide they want an industry to be Chinese, they make sure that those companies are all incapable of failing. And so they're able to sell below cost for many years until the American companies go out of business. And then the Americans file a WTO complaint, and that works its way through the system for just under the two-year limit. And then the WTO finds in America's favor, and guess what? All the American companies are out of business, and the Chinese have bought them at bankruptcy. And on top of that, you find out the Chinese use their military to hack into the information systems of the same solar companies, steal their technology to develop their competitive products, and then they hack into those companies again when they have the ability to buy those companies at bankruptcy, with access to the, you know, internal emails of the CFO and the CEO of the company being sold to make sure China got the best deal. That's how they roll. And they've currently targeted the commercial space industry as something they want to do. So there's been a lot of hoorah about several Chinese space companies launching small rockets. But if you read my article and you look at the links there, you'll find out that the majority of these companies are launching three-stage solid rocket systems off of mobile launchers. And the fact of the matter is that these are ICBMs coming directly out of a military factory owned by the Chinese government and being provided to these nominally commercial space companies, many of which are, in fact, also directly owned by the government through a series of companies, or are founded by people who spun right out of a government agency, and we're essentially given some ICBMs to do a space launch so they can say we have a commercial space company. And the point here, to be clear, is both the Russians and the U.S. have taken retired ICBM motors and redeployed them into rockets like the Minotaur-class rocket here in the U.S. But those are missiles that have been sitting in our silos for years that we're taking down, so we're building less ICBMs, and we're taking them out of the arsenal and using them for something. The Chinese are building new ICBMs, both to aim at our country and in order to launch satellites for commercial companies far below the market price. And they've been throwing a price around of $5,000 per kilogram. And if you look at the new startups in the U.S. that are coming out, companies like Rocket Lab and Firefly, Virgin Orbit, Relativity Space, these companies are looking at probably five times that or more as their starting price for small launchers. And for the Chinese to come out and undercut the market by 80% with state-owned money, state-owned banks behind them, and ICBMs as launch vehicles, it is a way to take over market and put the Americans out of business. And we should be honestly very awake about that and not just cheering on our international competitor because they're launching something to space.
Are we awake about it, in your opinion?
No, not at all. Too many of the space people that I run into have a kind of positive globalist perspective, and I love that. Again, I think I mentioned early on, we're all Star Trek fans, and we want to live in a universe of multiculturalism, diversity, and all, but, you know, sometimes there really are Romulans out there, and, you know, if the government isn't good, or the board, you can't simply play nice with them and cheer the board on, and the Communist Party of China, in a lot of ways, is like the Borg. If you look what they do to their own people, you can't expect them to treat us too well. So that concerns me immensely. We are not being honest about that. On the satellite front, they're planning to launch both communications constellations and Earth imaging and constellations to compete with companies like Planet. And again, that sounds fine, but they're going to undercut the market price. And guess what's going to happen when all your Earth imaging data comes from China? I guarantee you won't get any up-to-date images from Tibet. You won't get up-to-date images of the concentration camps that China is building in Xinjiang province, where they're locking up the Muslim Uyghurs by the millions. You won't get communications that include words like democracy and freedom of speech or Tiananmen Square. And that's not a future that mankind can afford. We need to see this next generation of commercial space led by the United States, because we're the only country that's going to bring diversity and inclusion and honesty and the rule of law to that environment. And it's important we do it and be honest about who it else it is that's trying to do that.
Alan is in Los Angeles, and he says, how do Chinese lunar plans, we hear a lot about that lately because of the U.S. proposed lunar plan, but how did the Chinese lunar plans and strategies mix with ours and with our timelines? Do we need to be concerned about China and the moon?
Yes, we need to be concerned, and to some extent there's good things happening there. I think it's good for the United States to have a peer competitor because we react better when we see somebody else is interested. And so we did much better when we had the Soviet Union around to prod us on in space. So to that extent, I'm kind of happy the Chinese are there, but their goals are to tie up important real estate now on the moon, lunar resources in the South Polar region they've been explicit about, where we all know that there's frozen water ice, potentially frozen carbon dioxide or methane, that are extremely valuable resources. There are also key strategic places that you can locate solar power stations at the poles, where you'll always be in the light, the mountains of eternal light. They're also interested in tying up the Lagrange 1 and 2 points in the Earth-Moon system, and they've already got a communication satellite at the lunar L2 point. Those are extremely strategic for a number of reasons, one of which is you can build a lunar space elevator from the surface of the moon to those points, and data suggests that we could actually build that lunar space elevator today with existing materials, whereas an Earth-bound space elevator requires some advancement in nanotube production or something that just isn't quite in our material basket yet. So the Chinese are being thoughtful, aggressive competitors. If they were not an evil dictatorship, I'd be pretty excited about it. I wish that was the Europeans, frankly. I'm glad that we're seeing countries like the UK and Japan step up, though, as well, to get more interested in what's happening in space.
You have Alex in Houston, and he says, I listen to a lot of space shows, and last year and some this year, David had lots of programs on should we or should we not have a space force. And he had various people on that say they advise and consult to the government that spoke about China much the way you're speaking about it. Many of the listeners who phoned in or emailed in dismissed that, said people were Chinese fear-mongering, and none of this was necessary. My question is, how do you reach people? I don't know the percentage in our industry, let alone the general population, who do not see China as any kind of a problem or threat. So my question is, how do you reach people that this really is a big, serious problem, both in the space industry as well in the general industry, and that we need to be aware? No matter how many shows David did last year, he did not reach the people or change people's opinion, because the same people called in when all of the consultants were on at different times with the same comments.
Yeah, well, that's a great question and a couple of good points there. One, if you talk to people who work in government, they usually have the same position I do, although I tend to be, frankly, more outspoken about it than anybody. But that's because they know more about it. And the more you know, the less you're going to be comfortable. It's not a good situation, and it's not a situation that gets better with access to more knowledge on the topic. It's a frightening situation. And I would encourage the members of the average public, again, who I think are very well-meaning and want to live in a world where everybody just gets along, to, again, think about the reality of the fact that there are bad people in the world, and the ones that are running the Chinese government, not the people of China, but the ones that are running the Chinese government, exist in a system of power and hierarchy that you can only get control of by doing some pretty terrible things. It's just the way that the Communist Party system works. You climb to the top by stabbing other people in the back. And it's a system where truth is power. There are no absolute truths. There are no goods and bads. There are no objective moral standards. Whoever is capable of telling you how things are is the way things are in that world. And I would encourage them, again, to look at the domestic situation of China. There are 1 million Muslim Uyghurs in concentration camps. Before that, they've been chasing the Falun Gong, a peaceful Buddhist sect around the country, and locking those people up and forcibly, again, deprogramming them from their religious beliefs and methods that are absolutely horrific. And these include brutalizing women with electric batons, locking a man I knew for many years up in a box the size of a refrigerator, and he told me the best days were when a lizard or a mouse managed to crawl into his box so that he could eat it. That is what's happening in the Islamic country. Amnesty International, you know, not a group known for its right-wing positions, reports every year that China has executed more people than the entire rest of the world combined. We don't even know what that number is. You know, the U.S. might execute a dozen or few people a year. China is executing thousands, like 3,000 or more a year. But, of course, they keep it a state secret because they don't want people to know. If a country does that, you can't expect them to behave well in space. And if we're carrying the genesis of humanity out into the solar system for the first time, we want it to bring with us the values that make humanity a great and noble species and not the sort of barbarism that's going on in China today. And you don't see that when you go to Shanghai or Beijing on a business trip. You're going to have a darn good time. If you go as a student over there, they're going to treat you nice. They're consummate hosts. They hide what's going on there, but it's very easy to find if you have the honesty and the courage to get on the internet and start looking around or talking quietly to your Chinese friends who are honest. It's not a good thing.
Carla in New Mexico says, is it true or even remotely possible that Chinese students in the United States are agents of the Chinese government? I constantly hear this. I don't know if it's BS or not.
It's true. Both students at the undergrad and graduate level, as well as professors, and this is not to say all of them, but we constantly find U.S. counterintelligence catching them in these missions. But to be clear, the way it usually works with the Chinese is not at all the way that it worked in the old Cold War with the Soviets, where you had a professional class of intelligence officers and spies in a hierarchy. With China, when a student or a professor comes to the United States or any other Chinese national, their organization has a Chinese Communist Party cell within it. So every business in China that has more than 50 workers in it is required to have a Communist Party apparatus in the business by law. Every university has a Communist Party apparatus in it. And they are debriefed by these Chinese Communist Party individuals whose job it is to make sure that they're politically correct at all levels of the university. So the university has a president and a dean and all the usual categories of hierarchy, but it also has a parallel structure with the general secretary of the Communist Party and all his workers. And when I've been to China, I've met these people and been introduced to them, and they're VIPs in the institution. And they talk to the students about who they will be able to meet in the United States, what companies they're going to be able to work with. And then the students are usually required to return to their local consulate or embassy in Los Angeles. That's on Chateau Way in Los Angeles, and they go there, and they're asked who they've met, what companies are they able to get internships, where do their friends work, and this information's recorded, and then nothing's said. And then what happens is at some point in the future, somebody from the Ministry of State Security, the Chinese Intelligence Service, will reach out to them. And it's usually something along the lines of, oh, we understand that your father is applying for a job at the State Bank of whatever, or the Ministry of whatever, or that your mother is ill and requires medical attention, and we could assist you with this if you could simply assist us with your friend who works at Aerospace Company X. And so it's a very hard-to-track system that is quite nefarious, but it's well known in the counterintelligence field, it's become very apparent in the university and research laboratories of our country, where we have many brilliant and highly qualified Chinese students who have never done anything wrong, to be perfectly honest, but it's hard to know who's who.
So how do the labs and the universities deal with this problem if they are aware that it exists?
Right now, they simply don't.
They don't deal with, okay.
They don't. And honestly, if you look at many of the top research labs in the United States universities, many of them are more than half occupied by Chinese national students. And again, many of these are great students who I'm happy to have in our universities. But again, you don't know. And you have to question whether that number of foreign nationals from a country that is actively engaged in military buildup aimed at the U.S. and its allies makes sense. I think that's an interesting policy question. I would like to read you real quick from the website of a Chinese commercial satellite firm, Chang Guang, who's launching a constellation called the Jilin 1 constellation of Earth observation sites. And this is directly from the English language version of their website. And it says, the proportion of party members is about 43%. It is a young and vigorous Communist Party member team with high fighting capacity. And it goes on from there about how communist they are and what is nominally supposed to be, quote, a competitive commercial space firm. And that's, either somebody's lying to us or Karl Marx is turning over in his grave, but it's an odd situation.
I have time for one more question, listeners, and so if you do want to get something in the 11th hour, you need to hurry up or you need to call hurry up. Bill is in Philadelphia, and he says, I do think there's a lot of Chinese fear-mongering here. China signed the Outer Space Treaty. My understanding is that China doesn't break the treaties that they sign. Where is the problem regarding space? You're laughing, so what part of it?
I'm laughing. I would suggest that the caller look at the WTO, World Trade Organization, agreements that China has signed. Unfortunately, I don't have an hour to go into all the details of how they've ignored that treaty and essentially every other treaty, particularly ones regarding human rights. That they signed. But the main thing I would point out is please go online and Google the Constitution of the People's Republic of China and look up Articles 33 through 40, where you'll find out that they guarantee human rights, freedom of speech, the right to assembly, the right to political protest, the right to be protected from search and seizure, the right to freedom of the press. None of these things exist in China. And this is their own constitution, their most sacred treaty with their own people. And if that document is no more valuable than toilet paper, then I don't think that any agreement that's signed with with foreign barbarians is likely to be honored to any extent.
What articles? What articles did you say to read?
I believe it's 33 through 40.
Okay. And by the way,
you'll find the English language translation on the People's Daily website, but you can just Google Constitution of the People's Republic of China. The other thing that I just looked into and discovered is the ozone hole has started to become a problem again. And guess why? It's because the Chinese are cheating on the Montreal Protocol, where they promised to end the use of carbon CFCs. These chlorofluorocarbons are again threatening our atmosphere. They've walked over all endless numbers of environmental treaties that we could go into, and it's the main reason the U.S. wouldn't sign on to most of the climate control regimes from Kyoto, is the fact that the Chinese simply are just going to cheat.
What about the Outer Space Treaty? Have they violated it? Do they honor it? What do you know about China and the OST?
Yes. To our knowledge, no. And to our knowledge, nobody's really violated the Outer Space Treaty. The clause we're concerned about is the prohibition against weapons of mass destruction being, placed in orbit, orbital nuclear platforms or other weapons of genocide. And to our knowledge, no, they've not done that. Neither has anybody else. That said, they're certainly actively militarizing space, and their attack on one of their own satellites in 2007 created the largest space debris field that has ever been generated. People are angry about the Indian test, but the Indian test is resulting in a fairly low altitude set of debris, almost all of which will deorbit shortly. The Chinese test created stuff that's going to threaten human spaceflight for decades, and the International Space Station had to be moved several times to accommodate the Chinese debris field from their ASAT test. They're also have been using lasers to target American satellites and a variety of other things that are not violations of the treaty per se, but certainly unsavory.
I have one last email that just came in from James in Kansas City, and he says 2 points for what they're worth. Number one, President Trump and the administration claim that China is not honoring any of the trade commitments that he agreed to with the Chinese premier several months ago, hence he's putting new tariffs on. I have no way to check the validity of the administration's perspective or what China is doing. I only say that because it is consistent with what your guest is talking about tonight. And number two, while toilet paper generally has no or little value, talk to people in Venezuela. I'll bet they'd pay a fortune for toilet paper.
Yeah, well, there's another example of where communism will get you. And it's important to realize the Chinese government supported Venezuela's regime to the end, and it probably wouldn't be there if it wasn't for them. The North Korean regime certainly wouldn't be starving children to death and doing the horrid things they've been doing if the Chinese government hadn't been backing them up for 50 years. And we've got to realize that when you look at somebody and you see who their friends are, when your friends are Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and North Korea, one might question your ethics.
Are any of these topics covered at ISDC, for example, on the policy day?
Absolutely not. No, and they're not a position of the National Space Society. Although the Chinese issues are entirely my own position. The NSS looks at cooperation with all countries as being a positive issue.
Anything we've missed or you would have wanted to say about any of these topics, ISDC, China, economics, anything else before we say goodnight?
Well, I could go on. It's a good conversation, and I thank you, David, for having the courage to bring that all up, because sometimes it's a message people don't want to hear. There's a great quote that it's hard to explain something to a man when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it. And often when you're talking about the China trade issues or other China issues, that's what's really going on.
Greg, we thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and perspectives. I look forward to your latest article you mentioned in Foreign Policy and to seeing you in a month in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, David. Ad Astra.
You too.
Best wishes.
You too.
Listeners,
back tomorrow with our regular Tuesday night space show program. Everybody have a great week. If you are at ISDC, make sure you find me. If you want to know my cell phone, in order to text me, email me, I'll give it to you. I won't put it out over the air. And, of course, Greg will be there. If you meet him, tell him you heard him on the space show. Everybody have a great week. Greg is already off the line. But we thank him profusely for being with us tonight. And so for the space show tonight, good night from Greg, good night from David, and good night from all of you who sent in emails. And again, we thank you for your participation in tonight's program. Back tomorrow, Bob Zimmerman is our guest. Have a great evening, everybody, and a great day tomorrow.